Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up over the next half hour, tens of thousands of young people gather in Geneva, Switzerland, to celebrate Europe's annual TESE meeting. We'll hear more about the community and why it draws so many young people to its doors. And as the Church remembers the Feast of the Holy Innocents, what one missionary is doing to empower children and the poor in an unexpected place. Young adults from all over Europe and around the world are gathering in Geneva, Switzerland, for the annual European meeting organized by the TESE Ecumenical Community. The focus of the event, which concludes January 1st, is overcoming divisions among Christians and barriers to peace by choosing reconciliation. The program includes prayer and reflection workshops, which are being held in parishes across the city. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon wrote a message of support to the TESE community, and Pope Benedict was among the many religious leaders to send words of appreciation and encouragement to the participants of the Geneva meeting, inviting them to open new paths of hope in a society so challenged by threats to the family and loss of values. But how did the community first take root, and why does it hold so much appeal? One of Pope John Paul II's and Pope Benedict's deepest wishes has been the union of Christianity's churches of East and West. For well over half a century, a once small community in France's southern Burgundy region has been trying to put that desire into practice. TESE has grown into a worldwide ecumenical movement, especially involving young people. It has become a byword for ecumenism based on prayer and meditation. TESE is the name of a unique monastic community in France that groups more than 100 men, Protestants and Catholics, from 25 different nations. Young people from all over the world visit TESE to be part of community life for a week at a time. Depending on the season, the number of young visitors each week ranges from a few hundred in the winter months to several thousand during the summer vacation period. During Holy Week leading up to Easter, more than 10,000 young people flock to the community, by far the highest number of visitors of the whole year. The TESE community was founded in 1940 by Brother Roger, who remained its leader until he was killed in 2005. Its current prior is Brother Alois, a German Catholic appointed by Brother Roger to be his successor. In a recent visit to Rome, Brother Alois was received in audience by Pope Benedict. Afterwards, he spoke to Susie Hodges about the TESE philosophy and his meeting with the Pope.
He had so touching, wonderful words about Brother Roger after the death of Brother Roger, and still 1 year afterwards, at the anniversary of the death of Brother Roger, he spoke in such deep words about him, and this created for us a very deep link. And he was very interested in how the community continues and what is happening with the young people. Yes.
And what message did he give you for the Teze community?
He encouraged to continue on the way of looking for Christ, going towards Christ with the young people in the communion of the church. And this was also the message of Brother Roger. We cannot find Christ without the communion of the church. To open ourselves for the others and to look for Christ, this is the same movement. And I think it's the same perspective that we have in Teze together with the Holy Father.
And what do you think makes Teze unique? Because it's often described that way, isn't it?
No, we are not unique. We are one community, a monastic community that lives in the church and that wants to give a contribution for reconciliation and today for the question how to transmit faith to the next generation. But we do this together with so many people.
Now, I know that Teze is visited each year by thousands and thousands of young people. What do they tell you they're seeking?
A sense for their life. And I think for many young people, this is really an existential question now that they bring. They formulate it less or more clearly, but they come with this question. And what can give sense to my life? How is it possible to believe today in God in our modern society where we are minority? Young people suffer sometimes from the fact that looking for faith brings them in a situation of minority. Nobody understands this. And to deal with these situations, that's important.
And what kind of feedback do you get afterwards? Can you tell us about some particularly memorable feedback you get from some of these young people? Some chance remark?
Oh, so many letters we receive or young people who come back. Often they say, for example, in Teze, the silence has been important for me. And isn't this astonishing? In our society where young people want to always to have a noise and always fill out silence, because silence means solitude. The modern life does not give a place for silence. Very often they say silence has been important, and this means that they discover perhaps in Teze a deeper longing that is present but that does not come to the surface in daily life. The same thing with simplicity. People say the simplicity in the life of Teze, it has to be simple because the young people give a financial contribution to the life there and we cannot have very luxurious means in Teze. But the simplicity, and this also goes against the modern life, so a deeper longing is awakened.
How easy was it for the Teze community to carry on after the horrifying assassination of Brother Roger? An act of violence in a community of peace.
Yes, it was horrifying, yes. But at the same time, we were carried, and I cannot say it in a different way, we were carried by God and by the communion of the church. And this allowed that we continued immediately to continue to welcome the young people, to continue the prayer life, to continue with the European meetings, to go to Calcutta, to go now to Bolivia, to go into the situations of the young people. And now I can say that the young people understood that Brother Roger did not point towards himself, but like John the Baptist, he pointed towards Christ and towards the communion of the church. And the young people understand this. And the prayer life continues in the same, with the same intense way. And we were astonished that during last summer there were more young people coming than before.
How many young people do you get on average a week during the summer?
3,000, 4,000, 5,000 each week. And from all the countries and other continents also. Those coming from other continents are prepared by their local churches and they stay for 2 or 3 months in Teze. But the people from Europe only stay for 1 week. Some do stay another week for having a week of retreat in silence. But for example, from Romania, we have each week 10 buses coming. And most of them are Orthodox, but also Catholics and Protestants.
You are a musician, and I know you've written many of the newer Taizé songs, which are sung throughout the world today. How easy is it for you to write these songs? Do you get a sudden flash of inspiration? And what are the main themes of them?
Oh, we speak together among the brothers. What can be the text? Because it's the words that we want to sing, and it's words from the Psalms, from the Bible, but also from the tradition of the church. We have to decide the language. We sing in Latin, because this still unites the young people from everywhere. So we have some Latin songs that we sing, but also we sing in different languages. And then we find a melody and a harmony, and we start to sing.
Finally, how do you foresee Taizé's future? Are you seeing any change or shift in its activities or its direction or the countries where you'll be involved?
Oh, we still have to go further step by step concerning this question. But the fact that we have smaller youth meetings on other continents, it's something that Brother Roger did. He went to India, to the Philippines, to South Africa, to Latin America. But we want to revive this now, to have youth meetings on the other continents too.
And do you find that these young people who are getting together with people of other religions, it's breaking down their prejudices about somebody who doesn't share the same faith as them?
Oh, it's a long way, you know, but if we can diminish the fears of one another, because these fears are source of misunderstandings and then even hatred and not having peace. If we can tear down the barriers of fear a little bit, then it's a contribution for peace.
Thanks there to Taizé Prior, Brother Alois, who was speaking to my colleague Susie Hodges. Well, for more information on the Taizé community, check out their website. That's Taizé, T-A-I-Z-E, .fr for France. Takes you back a few years, doesn't it? Well, Bob Marley's One Love and its message of social harmony and justice seem to sum up my guest today, an unusual man with a mission of mercy.
My desire is to serve the poor and to realize that the poor can teach us. It's a two-way street.
It wasn't long after his transfer as a young New York priest to Jamaica, more than a quarter century ago, that Monsignor Richard Albert realized he had a lot to learn from the poor. So much, in fact, that he's still working at it.
I like to say to people, when I first became a missionary, I was young and dumb, because I thought that, I was going to do great things for God and I was going to bring a lot of people close to Jesus. Well, God has done a lot of great things for me. It's the poor who taught me what it means to truly depend on the Lord in poverty. It's the poor who have really taught me that God has a plan for every single one of us. You want to see a poor person? I have a home for those who have leprosy. And George is 85, and he's blind, crippled, face distorted. And yet he's thanking God for all the wonderful things God has done for him. When I say Mass there on Wednesdays, it's the poor who teach us. It's the poor who can convert us. I give thanks to God that I'm on the way to conversion. Not converted yet, but I'm on the way.
Well, Monsignor Albert may think he's not converted yet, but that's hard to believe. This balding, stately man with piercing eyes and a thick Bronx twang has worked his way up to regional director for the Antilles for the Pontifical Mission for Holy Childhood. His St. Patrick's Foundation in Jamaica has grown into a conglomerate of 5 self-help and educational centers for young people and the elderly of the greater Kingston inner city and ghettos. I couldn't help but ask how he ever got started.
It became very overwhelming after a while. So many people needed things. One person had asked money to go to school. Another would ask to pay a school bill. Another would come and say they need food. And so I was becoming overwhelmed by all the individual requests.
But they were all coming from Catholics?
Coming from everyone in the neighborhood. Coming from people living on the garbage dump, people that are just roaming the streets. And I started a foundation, and it started with a group of little old ladies, poor ladies, who said to me, "Father, we have to help some people. The people in the area are hungry." I said, "Well, what should we do?" And they said, "Let's start a soup kitchen." And so we got a tire rim, and got some charcoal from someone, and we started cooking. And then the young people came and said, "What about us?" And I had guys that were 18, 19, 20 years old that were illiterate, couldn't read or write, couldn't tell time.
They were all helping you out.
Right. And the desire then was to see what we could do for them. And the whole maxim of give someone a fish today, you feed them for today, but teach them to fish, they eat for life.
Monsignor Albert is now feeding and providing career training to 1,200 kids a day, teaching them the skills they need to eat for life.
We teach them woodwork, sewing, tailoring, computering, welding, catering now, and give them a skill, and then try to place them in work. And if we can't place them in work, we try to start them off on their own. Like a little girl can do baking sweet things, and she sells them, and she can support herself. So the whole idea is to help them become self-reliant. The whole idea is to really help them become their own person, so that they're not dependent on anyone. Dependency is another form of slavery. I don't want anyone dependent on me. I want to free them.
Now, did you start all this off with people knocking on your door, or did you go out and actually look for people in the slums?
No, it was all around. It was all around me. I mean, whether they came to my door or whether I walked on the street, you could see hundreds of boys and girls sitting there, you know, idle, not doing anything. You could see old people that were abandoned and hungry. And I started a home for the abandoned elderly that also includes those who have leprosy now. Because no one wants them, they had nowhere to go. And yet they form a beautiful, perfect family. And they're a great witness of faith, and they're a tremendous example of love to people who come and visit the home.
Do you see yourself that all of these initiatives have changed the lives of so many people?
I have some wonderful examples of one boy. I had these little treats to give out. They're like hamburgers. And one boy stood online, Roger, and usually all the kids would eat it right away, and Roger didn't eat it. He rolled it up in a napkin. And I said, "Roger, you're not hungry." And he said, "Well, today is my sister's turn to eat." And that's when I discovered in my neighborhood that people take turns eating.
Because you can only feed so many?
That's right, only because I can only feed so much, so many when I get what I can. And I went up to the North Coast where all the beaches are and where all the vacations are and all the holiday resort areas are. And I walked into a dining room of a very famous hotel, And I sat down with the owner of the hotel, and the maitre d' from the dining room came, and he was very nice to the owner. And then he turned to me and said, "Yeah, buddy, what do you want?" He was very rough with me. And I said, "What is this?" And he took the order of the other man, and then he turned to me and said, "I don't have all day. What do you want?" And then he smiled, and he said, "Monsignor, you don't recognize me. I'm Christopher, and I went through your first program. And now I'm head of the dining room."
How did that make you feel?
Oh, I give thanks to God. Thanks to God that I could be an instrument to free someone. And Christopher was a rough kid, but now today he's self-reliant.
When you say rough, you mean he was involved in...
Yeah, he was on the fringe of becoming a criminal almost. We have boys and girls, really not boys and girls anymore, they're young men and young women working in almost every aspect of industry in Jamaica. Tourism, the airlines, marketing programs, the shops, so that we have many different people working in different areas. And that's the success when, you know, a kid calls me and says, "Father, I got the job." Then I know, you know, it's all worth it. But people just need an opportunity, and that's hopefully what I do. I try to create an opportunity where people can get ahead, where I want that after they've met me, they're better human beings, not only practically, but morally, spiritually, emotionally. And that's why in all of our programs we have a course for 3 weeks before they begin to learn a skill, personal hygiene, conflict resolution, just trying to know who they are as a person. And God has been good.
When you say conflict resolution, are you talking about just everyday conflict, tension between you and a friend or the guy down the block?
Yeah, it can be conflict resolution, can be relegated to just a problem and a difficulty with your neighbor. It can be also, the gun business, the knife business. It can be, you know, this tremendous activity that goes on between criminals. And so we try to teach the kids from young.
What do you tell them?
Well, there's a whole series of developments in conflict resolution that you begin with that you try to point out to them that they can accomplish much more from a peaceful approach to a problem, and that violence doesn't retain their humanity, it destroys it. And you give them examples, and slowly but surely it has an effect.
What's the most frustrating thing that you keep finding yourself coming up against?
That I don't have enough money to help more people.
You're talking about that young little boy who said it was his sister's turn to eat. Do you ever feel that your hands are tied? That these are people you want to reach, but you can't?
No. It's not that my hands are tied. It's just that the resources are so slim, you know, to reach out to people, to include more kids in the programs. We turn away people. We turn away kids every year because we don't have enough room. Sometimes I can only feed people 3 times a week, the poor, elderly, who are left all by themselves.
What happens to the other 4 days?
Well, they just, you know, hold on as best they can, and they drink sugar and water, which sustains them. It's intense poverty, but, you know, we make every attempt. We do the best we can. With all the more resources we get, the more people we help.
Where do you get your funding?
I get my funding mainly through my mailing list, people that want to write me and send me. You know, I've had some beautiful things. I had one woman who was 88 years old in the hospital. She saw my interview on 60 Minutes with Christiane Amanpour, and she said, "I'm an 88-year-old woman. I've lost my second leg to diabetes, but I saw the film, and I'd like to send you this $10 to feed someone." People send, you know, every month. Some people send once a year. Some people send twice a year. But it's mostly through people that I make an appeal to, and it's my mailing list.
Those $10 that lady sent to you, what can you do with those $10?
A $10 can practically feed an old person for a week. They can buy enough rice, cornmeal, flour to put together to feed themselves each day. It's incredible how far it goes.
What did people think about you when you were first getting involved in this? What do they still think about you, this New York guy walking around the slums? What do they think about?
Well, when they first saw me, there was questions raised and all. But now after 26 years and I've taken on Jamaican citizenship, I think they see me as one of their own. And I give thanks for that.
I see you're very moved by it.
Yes, I get very emotional when I think of the great grace God has given me to do this. I'm not worthy of the opportunity, but I've been able to help so many people. And I've been able to do this, and not because of my own. I have a great group of collaborators, the people that send me money, that support me. But just to see someone become a total, full human being is a great gift. And it's a great grace. And whatever good I've done, it's because of God and His grace and His strength to let me do it. And I just love doing it.
Do you feel that you've brought people closer to the church through all of these activities?
As a Catholic priest, I'm there because I believe that's where Christ would be, with the poor, with the marginalized, with those that are weak and struggling. And that's why I'm there. Not to proselytize. Not to make the world Catholic. I'm there because that's where the Master would be. And as a faltering disciple, that's where I want to try to be. So that's first of all. Many people come and say, you know, why do you do this? And they begin to ask. And all throughout my centers, I have a picture of Mother Teresa. I have a crucifix. There is a religious moral tone to everything. But I'm there not to proselytize, but to proclaim a gospel of love, a gospel of service, a gospel of care to people. And people get attracted, and people begin to ask questions. And people then, all of a sudden, you see a kid that you never thought, and he's in the back of the church looking, not too sure, very skeptical. And all of a sudden, he turns out to be, you know, a magnificent lector or director of altar service.
My thanks there to Monsignor Richard Albert, Regional Director for the Antilles, for the Pontifical Mission for Holy Childhood. If you'd like to make a donation to the St. Patrick Foundation, or if you'd simply like to volunteer to help, you can write Monsignor Albert directly on his email address. That's Stella Maris, M-A-R-I-S, at Casnet, casnet.com. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. If you'd like to hear this and other programs on our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Again, thanks for listening.
Listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.